New Thinking Aloud is presented by the California Institute for Human Science, Mind, Body, Spirit University. Visit their website at cihs.edu.
Thinking Aloud. Conversations on the leading edge of knowledge and discovery with psychologist Jeffrey Mishlove.
Hello and welcome. I'm Jeffrey Mishlove. Today we'll be exploring the connection between parapsychological phenomena and the rare talents of autistic savants. My guest is Diane Hennessy Powell, a medical doctor trained in neurology and psychiatry. She is the author of the ESP Enigma, A Scientific Case for Psychic Phenomena. Diane is located on the West Coast in Oregon, and now I'll switch over to the internet video. Welcome, Diane. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
You've been involved in parapsychological research for a couple of decades now. You've made some very important and innovative hypotheses. To my understanding, people approach this field for different reasons. Many people approach it because of a personal experience or because of spiritual interests, but I gather that your interest in the paranormal emerged from your strong interest in science.
I have a love of science. I mean, I was not raised with any religion. In fact, I didn't even know that religion existed. And my father was a scientist, and he loved to educate, and my mother was an educator as well. And so we started out at Hanford, where my father was doing research on plutonium for the Atomic Energy Commission. And instead of toys, we had science kits, and also he would bring me home animals from the laboratory, and I'd on nature walks I'd find animals, and so I was doing this combination of like studying animal behavior, you know, just like they're, you know, like meditating on, you know, how does a slug respond to, you know, whatever, or a snake, or, you know, a turtle, frog. I mean, you know, I'm just looking at them. And what I realized was that what I was really most interested in at that point was actually animal behavior. And so then I when I was in college, I actually spent time doing research with a comparative psychologist, named David Hothersall. And he taught us, when I say comparative psychology, what he taught us was he would look at different species and he would describe what they could do different tests on them and see how they responded to, you know, various like behavioral conditioning paradigms, et cetera. And then we would look at, you know, what we knew about the, you know, the sort of gross anatomy of the brain of those different species. And we'd see these changes in the brain that correlated with changes in, you know, abilities. And so that made me, you know, really want to become a neuroscientist. I was thinking about becoming a comparative psychologist and was actually thinking about going in, you know, like to Africa and doing something, you know, like what Jane Goodall was doing. Then Diane Fossey, there were these reports coming out about what was happening with Diane Fossey, you know, with, you know, they really didn't like her doing research on the and the gorillas, and what happens is that you have these women who were going to Africa, and they were really effective at in the field studies because they were their vibe was such, for lack of a better word, that the animals accepted them. But the problem was is that the communities they were in didn't, because you know you have these people that are making a living by poaching, you know, these animals and et cetera. So anyway, I realized, well, okay, you know, that's probably not a good thing for me to do, and I thought I'll go into neuroscience. But then, you know, I started thinking about, well, I love animals so much, I don't want to do research on animals, and as I got better and better at understanding animals and even being able to predict their behavior, sometimes I thought, you know, well, you know, humans are just more complex, but, you know, evolutionarily, you know, we're still animals. I mean, this is, you know, what my thinking was. And so, you know, I'm not going to really understand human consciousness by studying animals. I mean, it's too big of a leap. And so then I became interested in, because I was doing research with, you know, in electrophysiology, I was doing recording with microelectrodes in the axons of crayfish, you know, and seeing how they responded to various, you know, drugs or whatever that would block, you know, like an ion channel. And because I didn't have problems with doing research on crayfish, that was a lot easier than doing research on, you know, some mammal or. And so anyway, but it, when I got into doing this kind of recording research, I became aware of neurosurgeons who would do recordings from people's brains while they were undergoing surgery, and they would still be awake because the brain doesn't have any pain receptors. And so I thought, oh, wow, you know, and some of the stuff that was coming back was just mind blowing. I mean, they would stimulate, you know, a spot, and then like an entire memory would come back. And I was like, wow, okay, yeah, this is what I want to do. And so I went to medical school with the intention of really becoming an academic neurosurgeon. And the program that I trained in was at Johns Hopkins, that's where I went to medical school. And the chairman of the Department of Psychiatry, Paul McHugh, had been a neurologist before he became a psychiatrist. And he had trained in psychiatry at the Maudsley in London, and the Institute of Psychiatry there. And his approach to psychiatry was it was just exactly what I was looking for. It was this, you know, approach where you're really looking at behavior, cognition, emotions, you know, all of these different, you know, aspects of consciousness, really. And you're then, you know, trying to correlate it with the brain and what you know about the brain. And neuroimaging was just starting, you know, and so I was like, okay, yeah, you know, I'm going to become a neuropsychiatrist like Paul McHugh. And so that's what brought, so that's my background. And then taking it a step further, how I got into parapsychology was that I had this belief that that if you're going to have a model, because I really was wanting to, you know, create some theory, some model for understanding, you know, these big questions. And, you know, I didn't have any prayer that, you know, that I'd come up with a model, that, you know, but it's like the goal is, you know, you're striving towards something, you know, and so, you know, like, this is my effort. This is my best effort. That's how science advances. And I thought you can't throw out phenomena. And I was really trained as a phenomenologist. A lot of people, when they think of psychiatry, they think of, you know, Sigmund Freud, and a lot of the, programs at the time that I trained were still psychoanalytic. But what was unique about Johns Hopkins was that the psychiatry was, it was that Paul McHugh brought in was that of Adolf Meyer. And Adolf Meyer had this approach to psychiatry where you really looked at the human being as a biological, you know, they have a biological component to them, they have a social component to them, they have a personal psychological component to them, and they have a spiritual component to them. And so you when people come to you and they are having problems, your first job is to say, well, which one of those realms is this in? And then the treatment gets, you know, chosen based on, you know, which realm it's in. You know, if it's a spiritual crisis, you know, you don't put somebody on an antipsychotic. But if their brain has syphilis and they're having, you know, all of these hallucinations, you put them on, you know, the treatment you would use for syphilis, you know, an antibiotic. And so, that was how I was trained. And it was really, to me, you know, a lot of the psychiatry of the future. I mean, Adolf Meyer was really ahead of his time. And so what happened is that Well, I was practicing as a, well, I was at Harvard as a neuropsychiatrist doing a consultation on a patient. This patient did a reading on me. She had been admitted the night before for a suspected heart attack, and she wanted to leave the hospital against medical advice. And if the staff think that the person really is not coherent enough to, you know, really show sound judgment to make that kind of decision, they bring in a psychiatrist to be the one who just, you know, documents that, and then, you know, and then they can proceed forward. And I, you know, I'm somebody who, you know, I care about people's rights. So my approach to things is to try to just reason with somebody, even if they're somebody who, you know, it doesn't matter if they're reporting all kinds of things that show that they're not living in the same reality as me. You know, it's just my natural approach to treat them with respect, and to try to gain their cooperation rather than use the heavy hand. And so I went in to see this woman, and she was this, she was half Native American, half African American, and very tall, you know, at least 6 foot, maybe 6 foot one. I mean, just towered over me. And she said to me that she was seeing ghosts, and that was, you know, and she was psychic, and she knew the tests were going to come back normal, and, you know, and she wanted to go home, you know. And I said, and most psychiatrists really would have just said, okay, you know, she's seeing ghosts. She says she's psychic. She, you know, this is obviously someone who's not using her good judgment. And they would have just signed the paperwork and gone away. And for me, I thought, well, I'll sit down with her. And I said, well, you know, I said, well, what, you know, when you say you're psychic, you know, what do you mean? She says, oh, well, I don't work as a psychic. She said, it's just something I share with, you know, family and friends. It's not something I do for work. She said, I'm actually a cleaning lady in a, you know, in a, you know, some facility across town. and she said, I, you know, I said, well, you know, you've been psychic for how long now? And she goes, oh, I've been psychic, you know, since birth. She said, I was born with the call over my face, which I knew was something that, you know, basically that's like the afterbirth, you know. Some of it's like blocking their, you know, their ability to breathe, and oftentimes they develop insufficient oxygen, and it can cause brain damage. You know, it certainly can damage, you know, the hippocampi, which are very metabolically active. And so anyway, so I'm thinking, okay, you know, this woman's had some, you know, brain damage. She had been born with a collar, and she looks at me, and then she goes, you know, she goes, you've got this white light over you, and I'm getting a reading about you. Do you mind if I tell you what I'm seeing? And I said, oh yeah, sure. You know, and I had, at this point, I had never heard of auras. I mean, or somebody saying white light, you know, this is like, you know, very foreign territory to me, you know, but I it's like you roll with it, because, you know, I was used to talking to people who were, you know, in their mind somewhere else. Because I mean, that's one of the things when you're talking with somebody who has schizophrenia, let's say. I mean, it's like talking with somebody who's on an LSD trip, you know. It's very, very similar in certain ways. And I always found it fascinating to kind of understand what it was that they were experiencing, and kind of see, it's almost like doing dream analysis when you're with somebody who's reporting this reality that's totally different, and yet it's like you've entered into their dream. And so I said, yeah, sure, tell me, you know. And she goes, well, first of all, your husband's a chemist. And it's true. My husband was, he was a medical doctor, but he was also a PhD biochemist. And she said, and he's applying for a job in two different cities right now, which was exactly true. I mean, that very week he was applying for a postdoc in biochemistry in San Diego and one back at Johns Hopkins. And that got my attention. Then she said, oh, you know, in his heart of hearts, he wants to go, you know, to one place, but you're actually going to end up at the other place. And I said to her, now she really has my curiosity. And I knew that in his heart that that my husband wanted to go back to Hopkins. I mean, he thought of California as sort of the land of the fruits and nuts, you know, as he would put it. You know, he was very much a diehard East Coast nurse, 13th generation Baltimorean, was even born at Johns Hopkins and had an uncle who, you know, was on faculty there, years ago. So, I mean, he wanted to go back to Hopkins. And she said, you're going to end up in the other one. And then I thought, okay, are we going to end up in San Diego? And then I said to her, can you be more specific? And she goes, well, name some cities and then I'll tell you which one. And so I named like 10 different cities. And then she said, San Diego, that's where you'll end up. She goes, and you'll leave psychiatry to write books. And you'll be very successful and you'll only have one child, a daughter. And I'm like, okay. And I mean, since then, I have left psychiatry to write, and I only did have one child, a daughter, and I was, I was very successful in San Diego. So, I mean, it was just so now I had to deal with this phenomenon that here was somebody who, she's either reading my mind. To me, there was no explanation other than that she was reading my mind.
Well, and reading the future as well.
And reading the future. And that's the part. So the first thing was like reading my mind. Okay. And I had met a mentalist, you know, when I was a teenager that I had just sort of dismissed, you know, who had me, because a friend of mine would travel with the circus. And this mentalist, when he came into town, he did this trick where he said, pick a book off that shelf and open it to any page and I'll read it for you, you know, and was standing in the other end of the room and was just reading it word for word as I was reading it. And, you know, when I asked him, how'd you do that? And he did it with more than one book. He said, I'm a magician. I don't reveal my tricks. And so he said, it's just magic. So I just, you know, so no explanation there, but I mean, I'm just, you know, teenager and, you know, so I didn't make much of it. But it wasn't until the future happened that I then looked back at what this woman had said, such that I could say, oh my gosh, she also knew the future too. How is that possible? And so that's how I got into parapsychology.
Well, at some point in your career, you took an interest in autistic savants.
Yes, I became very interested in autistic savants pretty early on. So part of that is because it really actually goes back to 1986 when I am somebody who is a neuropsychiatrist, behavioral neurologist. And so when Oliver Sacks came out with his book that gave an account of these twins with autism, and he came to Johns Hopkins to give a talk, and I met him. I was like, "This is it. Okay, this is so similar to ESP. I wonder if they're the same thing." And so, I went to in 1987. I went to England and was at the Maudsley and the Institute of Psychiatry working with Sir Michael Rutter before he was knighted for his work on autism and evaluating children with developmental disorders, and just became really, really fascinated with autism, and because it was such a mystery. And unfortunately, unfortunately for somebody who's interested in it, it was extremely rare. And when I went back to the States and took a position at Harvard, I mean, I was told, oh, you can't do research on, you know, autism. There's just isn't enough of it, you know. And that was something that Sir Michael Rutter told me, you know, before I left. Because, I mean, I was with him for 6 months, and I probably only saw a total of about 8 cases of autism. And so he was getting referrals from all around the world.
Now, are we talking about autism or autistic savants?
We're talking about autism that was autism itself, autism back then was only about 1 in 10,000 children, and now it's between 1 in 30 and 1 in 40, and so the incidence has increased, and over the course of my career, and it increased enough that there are not only more people with autism, but the more people who were savants, because about 10% of people with autism can have some savant skill. And then I discovered the work of Bernard Rimland, who's a psychologist who had a son with autism, and he studied thousands of autistic children. And what he said was that a very small percentage of them had ESP. And he gave accounts of stories of children who, for example, similar to Rupert Sheldrake's work, where they, would always know, when the parent is coming to pick them up, and even though the parent wasn't regular, and when they picked them up, they just started to behave differently. Had abilities in having a dream, of the death of somebody who then dies the next day, and that sort of thing. And I thought, I think that understanding them would really help, not only because would help parapsychology, and it's not just because I thought that they, if you find one of these savants, that they would exhibit it to a significant degree, but on a reliable basis. That's one of the things that I really felt was needed, was that somebody who is it's just like the synesthete who sees colors around numbers. I mean, it's an automatic thing. They can't help it. So somebody who literally lives in that world, rather than it being something that they have to bring on themselves.
And so you actually began to research that question.
Yes. After my book, The ESP Enigma, came out, I was invited to go to India by a woman named Maithili Shari, and she was someone who had a position with the government of India, and she had a master's degree, and she was working with autistic children, and she read my book on ESP and invited me to come over and do a symposium with her, and also to evaluate some of the savants that she had been working with. And so I went over to India and saw these children who had these stories of precognition, but I didn't really know how I would test that when I was over there for such a short period of time. But I made note of that. But what I also discovered was that all of them reported that all of the parents reported that they were telepathic. And I thought, well, that's something that you can demonstrate in real time. It's really hard to demonstrate, for example, some of these things like children having knowledge of languages that they weren't exposed to. It's even though there are these accounts like that, like Ramses, who knew 8 languages by the time that he was 4 years old. He was giving the alphabets of 8 different languages, but I have to trust the mother's narrative that he wasn't just while she was doing something else on the computer learning. Even though that's remarkable and that's a savant skill, it doesn't fall into the parapsychological. And so I thought I knew that skeptics are so critical of what's really already really good data that's out there, that I thought, I need something that nobody can criticize. And so I started thinking about telepathy, and I thought, okay, that is something, if more of them share that in common, and if that's something that I can then demonstrate just having cameras and, ideally 2 separate rooms, just showing what's going on and demonstrate it over and over again, then it's that kind of thing that might just shift the needle a little bit.
I gather, though, that along the way you came to see that it's very difficult to control the experimental situation to the extent that's going to satisfy a skeptic. In fact, they're never satisfied.
Yes. Yes. I mean, it is very hard to satisfy them. But I've done these experiments where virtually everybody who witnesses them is blown away. I mean, they walk away, you know, convinced that something's going on. Deepak Chopra witnessed one of my experiments, and he was so blown away, he left without his jacket and his backpack. We had to send somebody with him to New York to give them to him.
Can you give an example of the kinds of things you witnessed in these tests?
The first savant that I really studied pretty intensely was a girl named Hallie. And what's remarkable about her is that her father is a medical doctor. And when she started, when he found out about this ability, it was like, oh gosh, you know, this is... this goes against, you know, anything that I, you know, I was trained to believe. And so he lived in Wisconsin, and so he was familiar with Daryl Treffert's work on savants and contacted Daryl, and also found out about my work and contacted me. And so both of us evaluated her, although I did the controlled experiments and put a barrier between her and the therapist, and had cameras in the room to document it. And what we did was, is we'd have the therapist look at a picture card or look at a random 6-digit number, and ask Haley to type it out, and she was doing it typing on an iPad that's a talker that has an electronic voice that comes out. She was doing that initially, but then with all the cameras that arrived and the barrier between her and the therapist, it that kind of thing, you just, it's hard to impose that on a child who's autistic, who has difficulty with change or has a tendency to get overstimulated, expect, you know, that you can just do business as usual. So she had to revert back to using the stencil board, where she would use a pencil and point into the letters and into the numbers. And I'd say that, so I was generating these random 6-digit numbers. And then I was, because she was insulted if all you did was ask her to, just spit back what the numbers were. This is the feedback I was told by the therapist. I would turn it into a mathematical equation. And so I'd say, okay, I want you to give me the first 6-digit number, the second 6-digit number, then multiply them, and then give me what that answer is. And I was able to get, basically, she was out of 167 numbers, okay, that were in that kind of a format, she only made 7 mistakes. And each one of those she corrected the second go around, meaning that she made a mistake and then sort of went, and so profound accuracy.
That's very impressive, obviously. It's certainly worth looking into more deeply. But now I understand that when we're talking about these autistic savants like Haley, who's using some sort of a typewriter to communicate with, that she's nonverbal.
That's right. So what I've found is that, with the exception of Ramses, who was verbal, and there's a video of me and Ramses doing an experiment that went viral. It's had over 9 million views, and that was 9 years ago. And he was able to say in a very articulate way what the number was. But I'd say with that exception, the ones that seem to be the most telepathic are the ones that are the nonverbals. And I would also say that Ramses is, since he's either lost that ability or, you know, he's lost that connection with his mother. I mean, because he's a teenager now. And, you know, so right now the only ones that I'm working with are the nonverbals. And I have a theory about really, you know, why that might be. And every one of them is a child that was developing normally and then regressed. So the nonverbals are usually children that they were just starting to acquire some language, and then something happens that causes inflammation in their brain that then causes them to regress. And one of the things a lot of people don't realize is that the developmental process in the brain is like a sculpting process. And so during the first 4 years in particular in life, while you're learning a skill, that area is, certain synapses are being reinforced and other ones are being let go because there's a redundancy there that needs to be removed. And so the cells that do that in the brain are similar to macrophages, and they're stimulated by the same thing that macrophages are stimulated by. And so they can get overly aggressive in their pruning process. And so these children who are developing language to the point where they've actually been acquiring the ability to understand language, but they haven't developed the ability yet to be very articulate yet, that's where their language development gets arrested. And what we've discovered about these children is that their understanding of language, their receptive language, is still intact in many of them. It's just the expressive language that got damaged during that insult, whatever it was. And so if you think about it, the acquisition of language in a child is such a remarkable miracle, because we haven't always been engaged in, you know, picture books and, you know, spending intensive time, you know, pointing to things and, you know, and having them say it back, you know, back to us. And we haven't, that's relatively new in human, you know, in our cultural evolution for us to be doing that sort of thing. And yet we've been acquiring language for a long time. And so there's this way in which somehow this small child is able to know, when it's hearing these sounds, what it's even referring to, able to sort of differentiate a lot of signal from noise. And if you've ever studied another language, you can sort of appreciate how difficult that really is. And so it came to me that what if we're all telepathic at birth, we all have a shared consciousness with the mother at birth, that is, you know, something that, you know, is sort of described by a lot of mothers, that they sort of, myself included, that I would anticipate before my child would cry. I mean, I just sort of instinctively, if she was in another room, would know if something was, you know, was going on with her. And so this, you have this sort of connection that then once language develops, that sort of more primary communication tool sort of goes underground or disappears, but I think it probably just goes underground. And I think that it makes sense that having a shared consciousness would assist in acquiring language.
I think one of the points that you've made is that for the nonverbal children, the ability to cultivate telepathy becomes a survival skill when they don't have other means of communication. They need to hone that ability, and therefore they do.
Absolutely. So it doesn't go away, and it because it's their only way of communicating, they become even better at it. And yet at the same time, they're still acquiring language. So that's one of the things that blows these parents away when their child starts acquiring the ability to spell and to communicate that way. It blows them away that it's like they're still on track. It's not like, oh, okay, you know, this 14-year-old is, you know, writing the way that a 5-year-old would, you know, or a 6 or 7-year-old. No, they're writing like a 14-year-old because that's still evolving. The only thing that if we look at the brain, what was damaged was really the Broca's area, the area that is involved in the actual control of the muscles that are required for expression of language.
As a neuroscientist, I think it's rather interesting that, to my knowledge, you signed a declaration from the Association for the Advancement of Postmaterial Sciences, and in which you're saying we have to go beyond the materialistic model of explaining everything in science. And particularly, this would be true with regard to parapsychological phenomena. So you started your career by studying the brain, but I gather you've come to see that consciousness does not necessarily limit itself to the brain.
Yes, yes. I mean, I really have done a 180. 180 degree on how I think about this. I mean, I was as steeped in the materialist model as you could be. I had all of these experiences of, oh, you have damage to this part of the brain, you lose this skill. It gets expressed in the behavior a certain way. I mean, that really, when you see that over and over and over again, that kind of reinforces the idea that, you know, the brain is somehow creating all of this. And then when I started studying parapsychology, when doing the research for my book, The ESP Enigma, and then started thinking about what I knew as a phenomenologist, I started thinking, wow, okay, I'd heard of out-of-body experiences and near-death experiences and did some research into them. And I'm just like, how can we explain that? Because this model really needs to explain everything. And so I looked at all of the phenomena within parapsychology, whether it's remote viewing or precognition or telepathy. I looked at all of it saying, all of that needs to be explained, as well as the other anomalies. You know, it has to explain savant skills. It has to explain non-locality. It has to explain all of these things. And so that is what eventually led me to abandoning the materialist model, because it's like it doesn't explain anything. All it does is deny us any kind of, you know, credibility to these phenomena. That's all it does. It's the filtering system.
Even today, I think it's fair to say, in spite of mountains of evidence, most people in the neuroscience community treat that evidence as if it didn't exist at all.
It creates cognitive dissonance. I mean, I really see how difficult it is for people to switch gears, because you really get your it's like belief confirmation. I mean, you know whatever it is you believe, you know, it gets confirmed over and over and over again, and you can have a certain blindness to anything that goes against it. And I think maybe that's some kind of survival instinct in humans, you know, that keeps them, you know, sort of in this kind of more tunnel vision after a certain point. Because I see that a lot of people don't handle cognitive dissonance. And so one of the things that's one of the reasons why I haven't spent, except for these autistic savants, I haven't spent as much of my time doing experimental work as much as I have spent time trying to develop a theory for understanding how these things are possible. Because I think that's the bridge that can help with this cognitive dissonance. And after I wrote the ESP Enigma, I've connected with people who were, for example, alumni of Johns Hopkins, medical doctors, you know, just like me, after reading my book, it gave them permission to believe in these things because it puts all of this into a scientific language.
I gather that from our conversations earlier that the medical community didn't exactly embrace your work with open arms.
Yeah, it was mixed. What happened was my book was favorably reviewed, and it was actually purchased because of that. The major reviewers who reviewed it, like Kirkus, those are the lists that librarians look at to decide what books to purchase that year. And so my book is in a lot of, now, I mean, it's 16 years old now, but I mean, it went into a lot of university libraries and city libraries. Mm-hmm. In addition to having, you know, people that read it read a review of it in my alumni magazine from Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. And so they read the review and they're like, oh, okay, I'll get the book and read it. And so it opened a number of minds. And so I thought, great, you know, this is achieving what I want it to do. Is because I just think I was naive then. I thought, oh, you know, the problem is people just haven't really looked into this. And, you know, and so many people are not neuroscientists, so they don't really understand how insufficient the model is. They just don't think about it. They just take it as, you know, oh, that's a fact. And, but I, having done just, you know, I did all kinds of approaches within neuroscience that I really understood its limitations. And I even understood the limitations of medical scientists who were pursuing this, because their approach just isn't going to explain these other phenomena. And so I was, you know, that's basically, you know, how it was being received. And then it was my medical board that had problems with it. The medical board, first of all, the members of the medical board are they're appointees by the governor. They weren't psychiatrists. They're, you know, you can be from any specialty within medicine to be on the medical board. And so, you know, one was like a surgeon, another's a gastroenterologist, et cetera. I mean, their exposure to psychiatry, let alone neuroscience, is like so minimal. And they hear that a psychiatrist, who's the one who judges whether people are sane or not, is out there, you know, and had written a book on ESP, giving it some kind of legitimacy. It was just like a, you know, slam dunk for them that I was crazy. And without even reading the book.
We plan to do a completely separate interview on the drama that ensued after the medical board made that decision. I think it's a very important case in terms of understanding the social psychology surrounding parapsychological phenomenon. So I would encourage our viewers to stay tuned for that. It'll probably be released in a couple of weeks. And in the meantime, I certainly want to encourage our viewers to take a look at your book, The ESP Enigma. It's a masterpiece.
Yeah, thank you.
It truly is. Would it be fair to say, Diane, that at this point in your evolution that you would agree that consciousness is primary rather than physical matter?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The first time that I realize that is actually the result of going to this meeting that was with Gary Schwartz and Marjorie Wollacott and other people who were like founding apps. And in preparation for that, I mean, one of the things that Gary asked, he said, I want to know everybody's opinion. Is consciousness primary? And I thought, primary and fundamental. And he just posed it as a question. And I was like, it never occurred to me to think of it that way. I mean, that was my initial reaction. It was like, gee, I never thought of it, you know? And so because that was the question posed, I did it as a thought experiment. And in doing it as a thought experiment, I was like, holy cow. It was like somebody giving you permission when you do that test where they say, well, connect all of these dots and don't have your pencil, leave the paper. And most people they can't do it if they're thinking, well, I can't have the line go way out here and then come back. so they can't do it. But if once you're given permission, well, no, you could take it to the end of the room if you want, you know, if that's what you need to do to connect those dots. It's like all of a sudden you're, and that's the permission he gave me in asking me if consciousness could be primary, because I thought that really would explain everything.
Well, what an important note to close on. I know there's much more to be said, and I expect that you and I will be able to do a couple more interviews to probe these questions more deeply. But for now, Diane, I want to thank you deeply for being with me today. I think your work is very important. I know our viewers are going to be fascinated by your insights. So thank you for taking the time to be with me and the New Thinking Aloud audience today.
Oh, thank you very much. Pleasure's mine.
And for those of you watching or listening, thank you for being with us, because you are the reason that we are here. Book 2 in the New Thinking Aloud Dialogues book series is a tribute to parapsychologist Russell Targ, celebrating his 90th birthday.